everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded at the RNIB Talking Books Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week, Benjamin Myers discusses his haunting coming-of-age novel, The Offing.
Starting point really was location, which is where a lot of my work begins, with place or landscape.
We eavesdrop on the afternoon an RNIB narrator met the author of the book she's reading.
And she says the newspapers are full of Nando.
So we said it right accidentally.
Oh, good.
Great. Nando, fantastic.
And I celebrate Halloween by reviewing an atmospheric ghost story written by poet Helen Dunmore. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Ben Myers is an award-winning author, poet and journalist. His 2017 book, The Gallows Pole, won the Walter Scott Prize for Historical Fiction. His new novel, The Offing, is a poignant coming-of-age story set just after the Second World War. It explores a friendship that transcends age, class and gender. Like much of his previous writing, it's set in Yorkshire, from where he joined me over the phone. The title of the book, The Offing, refers to where the sea and the sky merge on the horizon. And that's rather a central theme to the book. There are lots of merging of different things, aren't there?
Yes, it's fascinating. Since the book came out, I've been doing interviews and talking about it. And there's lots of things that have been pointed out about the book, such as you said, the concept of various things or people merging. This almost happened on a subconscious level, I think, when I wrote it. But the sort of parallel between the sky and sea meeting could definitely be applied to the meeting of the two lead characters, or indeed the two only real characters in the book, Dulcie and Robert. The starting point really was location, which is where a lot of my work begins, with place or landscape. And in this case, it was after repeated visits to the village of Robin Hood's Bay on the North Yorkshire coast. And I read a lot of nature books, and I think it was in one of those that I came across the term the offing to describe that point where things merge in such a way that you don't see where one ends and the other begins. But also the offing is much a feeling to me, I think. It's not even a visual thing, it's just a sense of distance and space and the far reaches of the worlds that we inhabit.
That beautiful sort of golden hour that you get at the end of a day, or maybe as the sun's coming up, where you're not sure whether it's day or night.
Yeah, definitely. I've never written about the sea before either in any of my books, and it's such a sort of obvious, handy literary device, I suppose, for want of a better word. It's the sea is just like an endless metaphor for various things. But yeah, most of my books have been set inland. So for that alone, I thought the offing and the concept of it was a good starting point for this story.
At its heart, it is a coming-of-age novel with Robert, the 16-year-old protagonist, moving from adolescence to adulthood over the period of a single summer, where he meets an older woman, Dulcie, who at first sight is very different to him, but actually the two of them, their friendship ripens over the summer and they end up merging a love of literature and nature as a bond between them.
Yeah, the whole theme, the overriding theme of the book, I guess, is encapsulated by that bond that they have. And the theme really was that it's a book that hopefully celebrates the differences between people and shows in some small way that the distances between us aren't as vast as they might appear. Dulcie is an older woman of a very different background. It's suggested that she's from wealth and education and certainly upper middle class. She comes from a world of sort of bohemia and culture. And Robert is young, 16, pretty green around the gills, naive, and he's very much working class, as he comes from the Pitt Village in County Durham. And in fact, Robin Hood's Bay, which is only perhaps 90 miles from where he comes from, is a world away and is by far the furthest he's strayed from his home. So I created this friendship that emerged between the two of them. And again, it's only after that the book has come out that I've started to kind of wonder why exactly. And I think it started out as a slightly different story, but during the writing of this novel, the world seems to have changed massively in that the political discourse has become very angry and divisive and divided. And I think some of that has seeped into this novel in the sense that while writing it, it seems like the world was a place becoming more prejudiced and hate-filled. And I thought the way to counteract that is to present the opposite, which is a story of inclusivity and love in a way. It's two people who find a common ground. And as you say, the common ground is food and poetry and nature and conversation. And again, that's the message of this story, if there is one. I don't want anyone to think it's an overtly political book, because it's not at all. It's a personal book. But the overall message is that we have more in common with each other than we realize. And the only way that society is going to improve is if we start recognizing that fact and meeting in the middle, rather than standing in polar opposition to one another, which is what seems to be happening all around the world under different political regimes, but right here in Britain.
Well, I love the way that working class Robert, who you might expect to F and blind, is a young gentleman throughout the book and almost overly polite. And then it's actually Dulcie, this very well-bred, seemingly rather prim woman, lets rip with the swear words. You seem to love to turn things on their head.
Yeah, I think it was important, really, to not revert to cliche or stereotype. I've worked as a journalist for 20-odd years, and over the course of my career, I've encountered a lot of people from all different walks of life. And I try not to judge people on first appearances, because you're often surprised. But it was important to present Robert, who comes, as we say, from a working-class mining family, as someone who, I don't know, I feel that in literature in the past, if you go back to a lot of the kitchen sink realist fiction and a lot of stuff that's followed, which I like and I'm influenced by, but I think there's a tendency to present northern working class people as some sort of savages, or the expectation that they're going to swear or that they're going to have certain lifestyle choices, when in fact that's really not the reality. And I come from County Durham, not far from where there's lots of ex-pit villages. And although that industry is now over, I know from talking to people, and some of my ancestors were miners, that there was a real sense of self-improvement in a lot of those communities, because although it was a pretty horrendous job to be 200 feet underground mining coal, the coal companies did at least look after their employees, and there was an infrastructure in each village, so there was a chance for miners to go to night classes, art classes, there would sometimes be swimming pools or saunas, working men's clubs, variety clubs. So while mining was really tough, you know, a lot of people in those villages wanted to expand their horizons in other ways. And I thought that Robert was also someone who was kind of that world, but also looking outwards towards the wider world, someone who was ripe for educating through alternative means, which comes via Dulcie. Who, as you say, and then going back to what I said about being a journalist, you know, sometimes you meet people who are from much better backgrounds or financially advantaged or maybe even aristocrats, and they confound expectation as well. I've met people who live in big country houses who might be the scruffiest people you would meet, and education and wealth to me aren't related at all.
Now, one of the things that you've touched on already, and certainly seems core to Robert, and actually quite a lot of working class northern writers who I've read in the past, is that wonderful appreciation of nature and landscape, maybe because it's so different to the ugliness of the pit or the factory. It's something that's very much at the core of your writing. It came through incredibly strongly in The Gallows Pole, your previous novel, and also in your poetry. Were you the kind of boy who used to wander out into the countryside and soak up the nature around you?
Yes, I think I was, to an extent. I actually come from a sort of suburban background, so I'm neither urban or metropolitan or rural, actually. So I grew up on a housing estate that was built post-war, lots of cul-de-sacs and tarmac driveways and neat front gardens. But just about a minute from where I grew up, the estate ends and there's fields and lanes and scrubland and what is often now called edgelands. And I write about that aspect of nature and landscape a lot, even though I don't actually know very much about, for example, species of birds or trees. I've sometimes been called a nature writer, but I'm slightly embarrassed to admit that I don't know that much. It comes more from an emotional appreciation of surroundings. But also, growing up, my parents were keen walkers. So right from the age of 4 or 5, I spent a lot of time in the Yorkshire Dales or the Lake District especially. I was sort of getting dragged up mountains from a young age, which is something I'm glad happened. And that just awoke in me an appreciation of the British rural landscapes, really. Mm. But also a lot of what I write is in some way documenting the changing face of rural landscapes, because so much has changed or gone in the past 100 years, post-industrialisation. And the expansion of towns and the suburbs has meant that a lot of the countryside has been sold off or cut up or is being used for mass agriculture. And these are things I explore slightly obliquely in my work. But a question that I often ask is, where are we heading? What is going to be left? And how much is going to be protected and conserved for future generations? Because on a personal level, I take so much from nature and the landscape. I'm out in it a lot, and I find it really helps me physically and mentally and creatively as well. So yeah, each of the stories springs from a personal appreciation of landscape.
Yes, certainly in your previous book, The Gallows Pole, part of what inspires the biggest fraud in English history is the threat of industrialisation. The book's actually in the R&IB Talking Books library, and I enjoyed listening to it over the summer. Would you just like to introduce that for any listeners who might not have read the book?
Yeah, The Gallows Pole, it's a novelisation of true events which concerned a criminal organisation called the Cragvale Coiners, who operated in the 1760s in the Upper Calder Valley in West Yorkshire, which is where I live, and they were based around the town of Hebden Bridge and Mythemroyd. It's sort of very raw uplands, the landscape around here. People may know the area from the work of Emily Bronte, who grew up at Wuthering Heights, is set about 8 or 10 miles away, or the poetry of Ted Hughes. So the landscape is very wild, and as a result of that, it allowed this organised gang of men to operate away from the eyes of the authorities. And what they did was they took coins and they clipped the edges off them, and then they took these clippings or filings and melted them down and moulded them into new coins. It sounds like a very rudimentary, basic thing to do, but there was a lot of artistry and cunning involved, and a lot of organisation involved to go undetected. And in fact, they were so successful that they flooded the local economy with this fake money. And in fact, it was also the biggest counterfeiting operation that had ever taken place on British soil at that point. And I was aware of this story living in the area, but it was only when I was out walking and I realised I was walking a lot of the routes that the coiners must have taken while out on their missions to hide money and falsify money, that I thought this really needs to be written as a novel, because there are some historical accounts, but I thought it's so full of drama and there's such strong characters involved on both sides of the law that I decided to write it as a novel. So I did a lot of research and threw myself into it and spent a lot of time outdoors imagining what it must have been like 300 years ago in this valley. And the result was The Gallows Pole.
It's a cracking story. It has a gritty vernacular to it that meant that I couldn't really listen to it out loud with my kids in the same room. Did you feel that you had to reflect the earthy language of the Cragvale Coiners so overtly?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I wanted to write a book, first and foremost, that was authentic. And I read a lot of historical documents concerning the Cragvale Coiners, a lot of legal documents and news reporting. And while that was very handy for giving me the facts of the case and the true story, none of them conveyed what it was actually would have been like living in a very remote place in Yorkshire in the 1700s. So I just had to think about it a great deal to work out the voices of these men. And I think if you went in a prison today and talked to prisoners, you would probably find that some of the language is quite coarse and that there's a lot of vernacular and slang, patois, whatever you want to call it. So if that is the case now, then it would almost certainly have been the case in the 1700s. The Craigville coiners were men who grew up in and around this valley and almost certainly would not have travelled far, and they almost certainly would not have been educated. Most of them wouldn't have been able to read and write, but they would have been very good at swearing, and they would have been hard, tough men and women as well, I should add, because it's a hard, tough place. It rains a lot. It's a craggy, undulating land. And most of them worked as weavers or land workers on farms, so they did tough outdoor jobs. And they were also lawbreakers, and some of them were prone to intimidation and violence. Mm. So I think if you add all those ingredients up together, they probably weren't going to be speaking in Queen's English.
Nice southern received pronunciation.
No, yeah. They would have been very hard to understand by today's ear, I would think. I needed to convey that. And the other sort of aspect of that is also they were a criminal gang who got away with what they were doing for a few years. And such was the extent of the operation that their reputation spread all the way to Parliament in London. But to be able to do that, they must have had to instill fear within people to go undetected, I would say. One of the starting points for the novel actually was after watching The Sopranos and seeing how mafia organisations were able to thrive through fear and reputation and intimidation. So I applied that to a gang in the 1700s, which is why there is a lot of violence in the book, because there would almost certainly have been violence in their endeavours in order to silence people. And the historical documents show that they tortured and killed people in order to evade capture. So you have violent men who are very uncouth and coarse of tongue, but yet at the same time had an intelligence about them because they did something which was bold and creative and, for a while at least, effective and successful.
A voice is clearly very important to you, and Malk Williams reads the audiobook version of The Gallows Pole very powerfully. And I believe that the audio version of The Offing is now finished, and you got the narrator of your choice.
I did, yeah. It's been read by the actor Ralph Ineson, who hails from West Yorkshire, where I live. He's got a very distinct, gravelly, guttural voice, which a lot of listeners will hopefully recognise. He's had a lot of on-screen roles. Most recently, he was in Chernobyl, if you've seen that. He's been in Peaky Blinders. He's been in Game of Thrones, lots of things. He was my number one choice to read it for the audiobook. But he's probably more recognisable by his voice. I had originally hoped, in fact, I've still got him in mind for if ever The Gallows Pole is adapted for screen. I think he would make a brilliant lead character. But yeah, Ralph read The Gallows Pole and we kept in touch a little bit. So I suggested him to read The Offing, which is a very different book to The Gallows Pole. It's gentler. It's set in North Yorkshire and Durham rather than West Yorkshire. And there's sort of subtle differences in the accent. But he's done a brilliant job. And we also had it adapted for Radio 4 and Book at Bedtime, which was read by Kevin Wadley, who I grew up watching in Alfieda's Ain Pet in the 1980s. And Kevin went to school in Durham, not far from where I did, and did a brilliant job of reading the abridged version for radio.
Do you think it's fair to say that the more gentle pacing of The Offing marks a coming of age for you as a writer as well?
Yes, I think it does. I'm not a very good judge of my own work, or certainly not until some time has passed, because I never really contrive or plan anything. I just come up with an idea and go with it. The Offing, it had to be a gentler, warmer book than anything I'd written for the sake of my own sanity and preservation of mental health, really. It's a book born out of a sense of anxiety with the world and that powerlessness that comes with that. But yeah, it's also influenced by a lot of books that I've enjoyed in the past by Laurie Lee or D.H. Lawrence, H.E. Bates, writers who wrote about rural England. Mm. We'll have to see whether it's a coming-of-age book, because it depends what comes out next.
Are you working on the next book already, or are you taking a well-deserved rest?
Well, I have a collection of short stories which I've written, which is going to be coming out on Bloomsbury, I think in 2021, if not earlier, and that's called Male Tears. It's a very mixed selection. There's certain themes running through it. I'd say half of them explore rural life, but I have stories set all around the world as well in different countries. So I'm writing about new territories. I think it maybe straddles the divide between books like The Offing, which is quite gentle, and some of the more brutal novels like The Gallows Pole or Beastings. But it hasn't been edited yet, so I can't really judge where it sits. But beyond that, I'm also working on a sort of expansive project, which is going to be a four-part novel, or maybe four separate novellas linked thematically. But I think in order to continue work on that, I need a bit of a rest first. Been rather busy.
Well, enjoy the success of The Offing. I'm thoroughly looking forward to the unabridged version. And Ben Myers, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thanks for having me.
The houses sat haphazardly above the ebbing tide on a crumbling cliff face of loose soil and wet clay that was slowly being eroded by the salt spray and circling fret. The homes resembled stranded sailors shipwrecked by the storms of centuries. Time itself was chipping away at this coastal reach, sculpting the island anew in an age of uncertainty. I thought about how the sea served to remind of the finite existence of solid matter, and that the only true boundaries are not trenches and shelters and checkpoints, but those between rock and sea and sky.
Ralph Ineson narrating The Offing, written by my guest Ben Myers, out now in hardback, ebook, and audio, wherever you buy your books. And you'll find The Gallows Pole in the RNIB library as TB704076. It's a cracking story, but be warned, it's not for the faint of heart and it does contain extremely strong language. And Ben Myers will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life.
RNIB Library has all the latest reading titles in a format that suits your needs. You choose the books, you choose the format, we deliver to your door. Follow us on Twitter at RNIB Library or find us on Facebook.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, we'll celebrate Halloween with a review of The Greatcoat. But first...
Hi. So, do we just sort of start chatting, I think?
What happens when an author meets the person narrating their book for the first time?
Can I very quickly ask you about just a couple words I wondered about? So one thing I couldn't find, and I wondered if it was your own invention, is funette.
Oh, yeah. Is that like...
Lucy Ellman is an American-born British novelist based in Edinburgh. Her book, Ducks Newburyport, was on the shortlist for the 2019 Booker Prize. And so, thanks to the Booker Foundation, accessible audio braille and giant print versions were made by RNIB.
So what does it mean?
Cute things.
Cute things, yes. Are funette. And is that the way to pronounce it, is funette?
Yep.
The audio version took slightly longer than normal, though, as the book is a 1,000-page-plus stream of consciousness and is told in just 8 sentences.
So one thing you have where one word sounds like another is you say innuendo, and then a word we couldn't find, inundo.
That comes from the Philadelphia story where this wonderful child comes in right at the beginning, I forget her name, and she says the newspapers are full of inundo.
So we said it right accidentally.
Oh, good.
Great. Inundo, fantastic.
The narrator for the RNIB recording is Stephanie Ellen, an American actor and narrator based in London. She met Lucy Ellman at the RNIB Talking Book Studios during the recording of Ducks Newburyport. And as well as clarifying some pronunciations, they allowed us to eavesdrop on their conversation.
So, Lucy, I heard an interview yesterday. You read a bit of the book yourself. And then I started to get a bit nervous because some writers aren't very good at reading aloud their own stuff. But I should have guessed because of how fluidly, how incredibly fluent the flow of this book is, that you would be a good reader. And indeed, I thought, seriously, for a minute I thought, oh, they got an actress to do that. Let's see if she does better than me. And then I realized it was you and I was like, oh no. Because if you can read well, and you can out loud, then obviously you might have more ideas and be more critical about what you hear. So that made me a bit nervous. But
well, I love the way you're doing it. And as for that reading, I can only read if I practice and practice. And it's just a short passage. It takes me
a
day to prepare for that.
But did you, when you were writing, would you just stop and read it for rhythm? Or do you kind of hear the voice in your head as you go?
I think I hear it in my head. I think I've always read everything like that. I hear, that's why I'm a slow reader. I hear things. I have to hear the words in my head. It's pathetic.
No, I think it's fantastic because it's very poetic. And one of the things that happens over and over in this is our wonderful unnamed narrator. But actually, I feel like an eavesdropper because it's not like she's trying to tell us a story. We're eavesdropping and finding out all these things. And I think recognizing exactly how human thought really does work in this way. So often associative, isn't it? So I found often when the characters talking about her mother and thinking about her mother and maybe getting a little bit too upset, kind of like how the mountain lion comforts herself when she's frightened by purring. So she starts reciting things like lists of, beautiful foods that she likes or what she has to do when she goes to the store, sort of in a way not getting too upset because she doesn't want the children to see her that way, etc. And then often words that have something to do with these she's thinking of, but then another word that has nothing to do with that topic but sounds like it, has the same rhythm, or it rhymes with it, or the letter's the same. And I loved that poetry, involuntary poetry, and I think a lot of our thoughts actually are guided that way more than we think.
I don't know. It was one idea I had of how things might work. It's sort of hard to, remember how your thoughts work.
It is.
Replay it or recreate it. Yeah, so it's sort of guesswork.
So in doing that, has that made you really just think about the process of thought more deeply? And do you find even that your own thoughts have started to change because you know the tricks in a way?
No, I haven't noticed that. But I've been on vacation since I finished this book.
Oh, my God, deserved.
I don't even remember my dreams anymore at the moment. It's like once I turned this off, my whole brain kind of relaxed and went on vacation.
I can imagine. Maybe I know some duller people than you do, but often if someone tells me they're going to tell me what they dreamt, my heart sinks because they're dull, right? They're very dull. But these dreams are not dull. They're absolutely hilarious. And I've been doing that sort of amateur Freudian thing of trying to see if in the dream, because see, I've read ahead now. I know what happens at the end, which I won't let on. So I'm kind of looking for presentiments that at some level she understands some threats in her environment and that's coming out in the dream. I haven't found that so far, but I'm doing a lot of sort of guesswork, like could that mean this or that mean that? How did you come up with these dreams in the book?
Well, how I place them, it would take me a long time to dissect. But I do hate dreams in books in particular. And if a friend wants to tell me a dream, okay, one dream, I hope it's short. But in a book, I can't stand it at all. But I just thought if they're concise enough, they can be really funny. You're right.
Yeah.
So I liked that. And I do sometimes think about dreams in the morning if I haven't gone straight to the internet or something. And that's when they sort of bubble up while you're just waking up doing things around the house, and things come back to you about the dream. So I wanted to imply that stuff.
So when you wrote, it's just such a mystery to me how this vast undertaking has knit together so well. Did you sort of write different sections and then find ways to put them together later? Or was it absolutely just flow from beginning to end?
Oh, no. No. Sections and then putting them together like a jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
And that took years.
I truly am so impressed by the audacity of it, because after, I guess, Joyce, I don't know how many people actually try to do this.
I never intended to do something like this. It just turned into that project.
So at the beginning, did you not know what you were writing yet, and it revealed itself to you?
Yeah, basically, yeah. I wanted to write something about animals. I wasn't particularly set on it being a lion, but And I wanted to write about mothers, and I wanted to express my total despair, as usual. So I had to find a way to do all that.
I think you really did accomplish all those things. It is amazing. Like, I really have thought so much more deeply about, yes, indeed, animals, wild animals, so little a part of so-called civilized life, as though we really are, as though they're cartoons to us almost.
Yeah,
so much thought
right.
about animals, and just literally having to look up the names of lots of names I'd certainly never come across of different types of rodent or reptile. It really is an extraordinary education, and some of it a very disturbing one, and yet you want to know these things that have happened in America. This thing about all those massacres of the native peoples. I had known about some of them. I knew about the Trail of Tears and how appallingly the genocide, essentially, humans were treated. I hadn't all these particular ones, like the
Ohio ones.
Yeah.
I really scratched the
Janaden Hutton massacre,
yeah.
right? That was astonishing. And what's interesting is, you see, because it's her thoughts, she's not going, oh, yes, that thing that happened at Janaden Hutton, blah, blah, blah. It's like, at first, it's sort of in there as a teaser, and I looked it up to find out how it was pronounced, and then I got more of the details. So a lot of the things in there, now she does go into details about that later.
I think I did sort of think this is an internet age novel, and people can look up what they want. They don't have to, but they can if they want. So I'm not going to explain everything.
I don't think you should. And because we don't in our thoughts, do we?
No.
Except sometimes we'll be thinking obsessively. And that's how it struck me about the details of this particular massacre, because it's just so vivid to her. But I never get the feeling that you're like, okay, now I'm going to tell you something you don't know, reader, which is almost impossible not to do,
thank
I suppose,
God.
But you didn't. But there's quite a few things, like a lot of names of towns. And I would go to find the name of the town, and I would be looking at something out of Washington, D.C., reporting that a massacre had just taken place there. So there's this amazing method in what you're doing that some people might not ever want to. But if they do look it up, they'll see this thread. But in so many ways that you could have preached, and no one likes to be preached at, even if the sermon is worthwhile, you don't do that.
Yeah.
You don't preach. And yet, because of that, maybe, it kind of sneaks up on us all the extraordinary and valid concerns about the environment and how animals are treated and how humans treat each other, gun violence in America. Like, Jim, the producer's then been working with me. We've both been, a lot of these things we think, well, that couldn't have happened. That's too ludicrous. You know, various shootings by police and just absurd things. And we'd look it up separately, and indeed, it's true. So many of the things are true. And I keep thinking maybe you slyly planted some things that aren't true, but we haven't found them
fairly,
yet.
Fairly, I think.
Yeah.
I think it was based pretty much on what's, as far as I could tell, what's going on in that country.
Yeah. It's, was it important to you, the idea of having an audiobook version of this, so that visually impaired people would have a chance to experience the book? Was that something, I mean, once it was being published, did you think about that?
I wondered how my mother-in-law would be able to listen to it.
Oh.
Or get it, yeah. Because I don't think my father-in-law is really in the mood to read a 1,000-page book to her. But, it's very interesting work that goes on in this place. And I was really thrilled to hear that you could do it.
So many people, especially in the U.S., where people will often drive for 2 or 3 hours just to get to work, people listen to audiobooks, I think, maybe more than they actually read, you know, with their eyes in the old-fashioned way.
Yeah, they should stay home, read a book, save the environment.
Exactly.
But okay.
But you can also listen to an audiobook when you're washing the dishes or feeding. If you have those earpieces, you can listen while you're out feeding the chickens and things as well.
Yeah, that's allowed. Yeah.
And also, I think if something's daunting, like a very long book, let's say, if you are a bit daunted by it, if it's going into your ears, you know, somehow that takes any fear a person might have.
Yeah.
But I read something you told someone in an interview or something, and I totally see that now, is that in the end, it's like four average-sized books put together. And if you're a big reader, you would easily read four books in a fairly short space of time. So what's the problem?
I was really surprised. I mean, I was surprised how long it was when I finally put it all together. But I was also surprised that that was a big issue, because I thought only I hate long books.
What, do you hate long books?
Well, I'm scared of them because I'm so slow. Yes. So I have to be very
so
committed.
Interesting. Well, you really tackled that fear,
didn't
you?
It's not my usual style.
But see, I suppose, and that's funny, isn't it? Because, yes, I think sometimes I'll eye a book in a store, and I'll, if it is brick-like, I will sometimes go, not sure, because sometimes the reason people write really long books is they're being, as a writer, I believe, they're being sort of undisciplined and just sort of, oh, you know what I mean? They're kind of exulting in their own cleverness or something like that.
Or they don't know how to work a computer properly.
Yeah. Or they're just not very good at editing. And I do think maybe editing in the book trade is a dying art. But I swear to you, I don't get that from this, because you get more and more into it. I keep wanting to know more and more about what is going to happen to that mountain lion. You know, I'm so yearning for her to be all right. And what is going to happen in these various things? And are we being told about certain things because something is going to, you know, I'm crazy to find out what's going to happen.
Great.
Yeah. So,
yes, I think part of the novelist's job is to drive you crazy. And that, yeah. I don't mind doing that.
Yeah.
I love what you said about the purring. I never really thought of it, but I think you're right.
Oh, how
she
lovely.
She does comfort herself.
The fact that the raccoons are now banging an empty yogurt carton around on the driveway, the fact that in the early morning stillness it sounds like gunshots, the fact that even in fog, with ice on the road and snowbanks blocking their vision, people are already zooming around our corner, the site of many a minor accident. The fact that a guy in a pickup once accidentally skidded into our garage, and next time it could be our house or a child. Wake up picture day! Dicamba, Kleenex. The fact that a pickup truck killed Dilly. The fact that she'd successfully dodged cars for 3 whole years. The fact that she knew all about cars. But during that time, the traffic grew. The fact that it's crazy now. The fact that after Dilly got killed, the kids painted a big warning sign with a big black cat on it and stuck it right by the fence. But nobody notices it. The fact that they're all going too fast to see it. When the cat died, we had catnip tea. The fact that failure to yield causes 1 in 5 accidents in Ohio. The fact that car crashes are up 20% since 2009. And then what I wondered about was, it's the name of a creek or something? M-U-H-U-L-B-U-C-T-I-T-U-M, like Muhul.
Wow.
M-U.
I don't remember that.
H-U-L. B-U-C-T-I-T-U-M. So we said Muhulbuktitum. It's the name of a creek. Does that ring a bell?
Not at all.
Oh, great.
I'm sure you did find
it. Great, because that way, at least you won't be criticizing me like, that lazy actress did not find out the correct pronunciation.
I wouldn't be criticizing you at all. This is superb. We really like, we both
I'm
turned
so
to
pleased.
Each other. We were so pleased and relieved. And I mean, because one fears what might go wrong,
yes.
But I don't know what could go wrong, but you have done it so well.
I think it's
well.
Inevitable that I will have mispronounced some things, but...
everybody does.
No, here's a
camp... She might, too.
Yes, of course, see, that's it, of course, because in our thoughts we might very well often mispronounce things.
Autry, buckeye, black walnut, hickory, butternut. The fact that Stacy's old enough to handle the road, but the other kids aren't. The fact that a little boy was killed in his bed just the other day by a skidding car crashing into his house. Been asleep. The fact that there are 2 cardinals right now in the lilac tree. Brown sugar. The fact that 11% of Americans carry on driving when the fuel tank empty light comes on. The fact that, boy, you'd think it'd be more like 80%. Ronnie. Chicken feed. The fact that there are macrophages.
The fact that I dreamt I flew all the way to India to get a teaspoon of cinnamon. When I got home, I realized I needed flaked almonds, too. Security, holding pattern, go figure. Not in my backyard. Oh, the fact that we have to do our taxes and try to remember every little bit of income and expenditure. The fact that there was more of the latter than the former. Family Dollar, Zikers, password, username. Your card is now active and ready to use.
Thanks to Stephanie, Lucy, and to Robert Kirkwood. The Talking Book version of Duck's Newburyport will be available from the RNIB Library later this month. For more information on it and all the books on the Booker Prize shortlist from this and previous years, visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. This week it was Halloween, and so, before Ben Myers shares the books of his life, let's return to Yorkshire, the setting for an atmospheric and eerie ghost story. A few years ago, Penguin Random House re-established its Hammer imprint, inviting authors to submit novellas in the vein of the legendary horror films from the 1950s, 60s and 70s. Many well-respected authors did so, including Helen Dunmore, who'd already established a reputation as one of the finest novelists writing about the period immediately after the Second World War, with books such as A Spell of Winter and The Betrayal. The Greatcoat is set in winter 1952. Recently married Isabel and Philip move into a rented flat in the East Riding of Yorkshire. But while Philip has his job as a newly qualified GP to give him a position in the close-knit community, 19-year-old Isabel feels ill-equipped for her position as the doctor's wife. Brought up by her aunt in Norfolk, after her parents died in a Japanese prisoner of war camp, Isabel is unworldly and knows no one in the Yorkshire town. She barely knows how to cook, refers constantly to a handbook for new wives, and feels the unwelcome scrutiny of her purse-lipped landlady.
In the morning, Philip left for the surgery at 8, after riddling and stoking the kitchen stove. Isabel watched him. She had to learn how to do everything. Unlike Philip, she hadn't grown up laying fires, fetching in coal and wood, earning money after school and on Saturdays. She was soft. "Nesh," he said, when he was teasing her. By 10 o'clock she had made the bed, washed up, and laid their clothes in the drawers of the ugly old chest. Upstairs the landlady coughed. "Too close," thought Isabel. They had divided the house into flats, but they couldn't quite separate the lives within it. Outside the windows, an early mist was thinning. There would be sun. She would go shopping. Her aunt had bought her a book called Early Days, An Introduction to Housekeeping for the Young Wife. It advised that the young wife must make a friend of her butcher, fishmonger, and greengrocer. Certainly, thought Isabel, she had no other friends in the town. She might as well start with a rubicund butcher whose hands dripped with the tang of blood. She picked up her handbag and snapped its clasp with a fat, important click. She was a little girl, pretending to be her mother. She would sally forth with her mother's smile to coax an extra slice of bacon or assess a piece of cod. If the fish were whole, you could tell how fresh it was from the brightness of its eyes. Or so it said in the book.
The only thing about her new home that feels familiar to Isabel is its proximity to an abandoned airfield. It reminds her of the RAF bomber station in Norfolk near her aunt's house, and of the air crews who thronged the village during the Second World War.
In post-war Yorkshire, the tiny flat is freezing and coal is rationed. Searching in a cupboard for an extra blanket, Isabel finds an old RAF greatcoat. When she wraps herself in it, she feels not only warm, but comforted. The coat also brings a visitor to the flat, a lost airman called Alec. He is company during her long, lonely days, and relief from the grim realities of post-war trauma. Even if it is obvious both to the reader and to Isabel that Alec is a ghost. But the greatcoat is a haunting rather than a chilling ghost story. Alec is more of a lost boy than a scary phantom, and Isabel's creepy landlady is more wretched than malign. In using an everyday relic to conjure the past, Dunmore, who herself was a successful children's author, is writing in the tradition of books such as Tom's Midnight Garden. The coat's very ordinariness brings the tumultuous events of the Second World War closer to home. The Greatcoat is an extraordinarily atmospheric story that vividly conjures the privations of the years immediately after the Second World War. Absence pervades the novella, but those who survived the war are not expected to show their grief for those who didn't. And the lack of food, clothing and warmth hangs over everything, like the cold Yorkshire fog. Dunmore's style of writing accentuates the haunting power of the story by turns full of sharp-eyed observation, such as the hairline cracks that begin to form in the early months after a marriage, and at other times it moves effortlessly into a lyrical, dreamlike tone.
She stood watching him for a long time, half fearing that her gaze would wake him, half afraid it would not. At last she spread the coat on her side of the bed, laying claim to it. As if he felt its touch, Philip stirred and rolled away from her and from the greatcoat. He was on his side, still sleeping, with an armful of blanket heaved over his shoulder. The liner was icy. She shouldn't have left her slippers in the other room. Shuddering, Isabel eased her cold self between the sheets. The greatcoat came down over her, moulding itself to her, pressing her into the mattress. She woke with light in her eyes, like splinters. Philip had pulled the curtains back and was standing by the window, fixing his cufflinks. "You brute," grumbled Isabel. "It's 7:50. I'm off in a minute. What is that thing on the bed?" "I found it in the cupboard. I was freezing." He came close and peered at it. "Good Lord! Where on earth has that come from?" Isabel recognised the echo of Dr. Ingleby's voice and phrasing. Philip was going up in the world, she thought to herself, and then quenched the thought for its disloyalty.
It's a rich, powerful style and reflects the fact that Helen Dunmore was also one of Britain's finest poets. Her final collection of verse, Inside the Wave, was published shortly before her death in 2017 and posthumously won that year's Costa Book of the Year Award. For those not already familiar with her work, The Greatcoat is an entertaining and evocative introduction to a great writer. Like many of her books, it's available from the RNIB Library in Braille, giant print and as TB19910, which is narrated by Maggie Mash. Now it's back to Benjamin Myers for the books of his life. Ben, was there a book that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Well, there was a lot when I was a child. One that I keep thinking about, and it may be an obvious author to choose, but it was Roald Dahl. Danny the Champion of the World was a book that resonated with me. I was a fan of all of his work, but it was the stories which were somehow less fantastical that I related to more. Danny the Champion of the World, for anyone who doesn't know the story, is about a young boy living with his father in a little caravan, I think it's like a gypsy vado, and his dad is a poacher who goes out at night and poaches pheasants, until one night Danny discovers that that's what his father is up to in secret, and he ends up getting involved in poaching. It's a simple story, but it's one that's full of warmth and humour and has a real appreciation, I think, for the English countryside and woodlands and the animal kingdom. There's an excitement to it, and there's a sort of anti-establishment streak to the story, which is this man and his son who are kind of taking on the authorities because what they're doing is illegal. They're stealing from wealthy landowners. But I quite like that, a sort of anarchic subtext to the story. And it's a book that I think about often, actually, and it's a book that I recommend to any children. There's a timelessness to it which suggests that it's going to be read for decades or centuries to come.
When I was 4 months old, my mother died suddenly, and my father was left to look after me all by himself. I had no brothers or sisters. So all through my boyhood, from the age of 4 months onward, there were just the two of us, my father and me. We lived in an old gypsy caravan behind a filling station. My father owned the filling station and the caravan and a small field behind, but that was about all he owned in the world. It was a very small filling station on a small country road surrounded by fields and woody hills. While I was still a baby, my father washed me and fed me and changed my nappies and did all the millions of other things a mother normally does for a child. That's not an easy task for a man, especially when he has to earn his living at the same time by repairing motor car engines and serving customers with petrol. But my father didn't seem to mind. I think that all the love he had felt for my mother when she was alive, he now lavished upon me.
Danny, the Champion of the World by Roald Dahl is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library, including as TB14707, which is narrated by our old friend David Thorpe. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
The book that I would recommend on a rainy day would be a book called A Sport and a Pastime, by James Salter, the American author. It's a book that I only really discovered a few years back. I had read another novel by him, which was all about climbers in the Alps. But A Sport and a Pastime is a very a simple story, synopsis-wise, in that it's about two American men who are in France, and one of them falls in love with a French woman. And the story documents this relationship as seen by the third person. I can't even explain a great deal more what else happens in it, but the power of the book is in the strength of James Salter's writing. He's a writer who makes me want to give up writing. He's so good. Each sentence is poetic, and the way he describes food or weather or the seasons, climate, the French countryside, the relationship between this young man and this young woman, it's very fertile and fecund and earthy and a little bit grubby in places, but it's also beautiful and pungent and romantic. And it's a book that I think should be more renowned than it is. It's probably considered a classic by a lot of people who have read it, but I'm not sure if enough people have discovered it yet.
September. It seems these luminous days will never end. The city, which was almost empty during August, now is filling up again. It's being replenished. The restaurants are all reopening, the shops. People are coming back from the country, the sea, from trips on roads all jammed with cars. The station is very crowded. There are children, dogs, families with old pieces of luggage bound by straps. I make my way among them. It's like being in a tunnel. Finally, I emerge onto the brilliance of the quay, beneath a roof of glass panels which seems to magnify the light. On both sides is a long line of coaches, dark green, the paint blistering with age. I walk along, reading the numbers, first and second class. It's pleasant seeing all the plaques with the numbers printed on them. It's like counting money.
James Salter's A Sport and a Pastime is available commercially in print, ebook, and audio, which is narrated by Jeff Woodman. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yeah, I recently read a book called Ash Before Oak by Jeremy Cooper, which was published just this year, 2019, by Fitzcarraldo Editions. It's a very strange book. Ostensibly, it is the diary of a man who was in his 50s, who has moved to, I think it's Somerset, to a small farmhouse that he's inhabiting, and he's working on the land and cultivating a garden. So on the one hand, it sounds like a nature memoir, but it's claimed to be fictionalized. And as the novel progresses, we get deeper into the darker recesses of one man's mind, and it's becoming apparent that he's suffering a nervous breakdown. And it goes into some pretty dark places. But it was a very powerful book that I read in a few days while staying in a farmhouse, actually, in Herefordshire. And it's a book that really affected me. It impacted me. It's part poetry, part memoir, part novel, part nature catalogue of plants and flora and fauna that he's growing. But it's also something else entirely, which is a dark journey into one man's mind. So it's a book that I would recommend.
Ash Before Oak by Jeremy Cooper is out now in paperback and ebook wherever you buy your books. Benjamin Myers, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.